I always said I'm just a human being who witnessed and who see everything around us, who see these people who need help. And this is just is a responsibility to help each other. So I just started to help.
Welcome to The Whole View. I'm Stacey Toth of Real Everything. I'm here each week to dive deeper into how we can find happiness and health inside and out through self-love, body positivity, and discovering new ways to be our best selves. Before we get started, a reminder, this podcast is for general educational purposes and is not intended to diagnose, advise, or treat any physical or mental illness. And while Dr. Amani is a medical doctor, she is not yours. So we always recommend that you see a licensed health professional accordingly. I am very excited to introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Amani Ballore. I feel like I am talking to an actual hero, and I am excited for you listeners to meet her. Amani is a distinguished Syrian pediatrician, activist, and author, and Dr. Ballore's profound experience were captured in the Oscar-nominated and twice Emmy Award-winning documentary, The Cave, and her new memoir, The Cave, A Secret Underground Hospital and One Woman's Story of Survival in Syria, is now an editor's pick on Amazon, and I personally read it and really enjoyed it. I think that you listeners are going to really love her story, and she is recognized internationally for advocacy work for women's and children's rights, especially under the harrowing conditions of the Syrian civil war. And Dr. Ballore's experiences underscore the critical issues faced by civilians in war zones, particularly for women and children. And these crises are not only unthinkable, but they are happening. And right now in Ukraine, in Israel, in Gaza, we know that these things are happening and still happening in Syria as well. So Dr. Ballore, thank you so much for being here to share your story and providing global awareness and helping all of us figure out ways that we can take action.
Thank you so much for having
me. I'm wondering, because our show is usually very focused on health and wellness, like personal wellness, I'd love if we could start by first sharing your story about how much you had to personally overcome just to become a pediatrician. I think it's a really important part of your memoir and something that is not a lived experience that most first world countries, so to speak, can comprehend. There were a lot of different factors that went in, from your family to all different kinds of things. Can you share a little bit about that part of your story and being able to even become a doctor?
Well, it's a long story, because since I was a child, I'm from a conservative community. They don't allow, at that time, they don't allow to all the girls to study. So it wasn't easy to study. That happened in 90s. And I wanted to study. My three older sisters got married very early. So I just always said that I wanted to study, I want to be something important. And I wanted to be an engineer. I felt like it's something different and I can do something important in my life. But my father, as everyone in my community, have the same idea that you can't be an engineer. You are a girl. It's not for girls. And actually, I couldn't fight enough that time. I was very young and I just continued studying. And I got very high marks in the high school. I was good at school and I was able to study medicine. It's not easy in Syria to study medicine. You need very high marks. So not everyone is able to study. I didn't want to be a doctor at the beginning, but then I started studying medicine and everyone in my family and everyone there was proud of me, because doctors has a good position, especially in my community. So I started studying medicine and then I really liked it and I wanted to continue to do something special. I wanted to be a pediatrician because I loved children and I wanted to work with children, to play with them. Oh, this is what I for. And I was at the fifth year of the medical school when the revolution started in Syria. And immediately the Syrian regime started to kill the people, shoot them, then bomb them, then besiege the cities and the towns and kill everyone, starve everyone. So this happened. I graduated in very difficult circumstances in 2012. I started studying pediatrics just for a few months because then my town and all the area around me, like 500,000 people, were besieged by the Syrian regime and its allies. So I couldn't continue studying pediatrics, but I started working as a pediatrician because there were not enough doctors and the situation was very bad. A lot of children are wounded children, malnourished children. So I was forced to work and to help everyone. So I worked as a pediatrician, still studying, just practicing, trying to read all the time for more than 5 years. That time, yeah, because in my community everyone knows each other, so they say that this one is pediatrician. I wasn't pediatrician, I just started studying. So yeah, I was happy to help, and I was all the time afraid that I maybe do something wrong, or I wanted to read all the time, to study in very bad circumstances.
Yeah, I think that the way in which you speak about those very bad circumstances shows how much you lived in them. Because when you're talking about being in the middle of a war and being bombed and all of these kinds of things, and especially in the book, as you describe trying to help children and seeing that isn't going somewhere sometimes, it's so hard to imagine for those of us who haven't lived through it. And it feels very jarring and scary. And I think, you know, for me, part of what makes your story possible for me to relate to and to process is the humanitarian side of who you are and what that looked like, right? Just even the battles that you fought within your own family to not be forced into a marriage that you didn't want to be forced into at a young age, how you needed to find transportation to school, different societal barriers about a belief system that most of the people held about a woman doctor, like all of these things that while we might talk about not having adequate public transportation here or not having full equality where we live, it was an entirely different experience to read about what you went through as you were trying to become a doctor. And I think speaks to your resilience and fortitude and really wanting to do the work and to be educated.
Exactly. It's not easy to be educated in Syria, but in many other places also. But it's not important to go to school or to go to the university to be educated. You can educate yourself. There's a lot of, especially girls, young girls, they really want to study, to be something, to change their situation, to change the world. And they are unable to go to school or to go to the university in many places in the world. So we can bring them hope by saying you can educate yourself. You can try what is available for you. You can read, you can be on social media, do something else, but you can educate yourself. It's something that can happen anyway.
Yeah, the internet is allowing amazing borders to be pulled down, so to speak, in a lot of different ways. And I think speaks to also how much access to wellness is very different depending on where you live or who is raising you and those kinds of things. And I think when we talk on this show about the different kinds of things that we can do to optimize our wellness, and I compare that to the situations of people coming to you in the cave to get basic needs met, it's very night and day and a good perspective and reminder for all of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you talk a little bit about the differences between the documentary, The Cave, which was a couple of years ago, I think, and then, oh, actually 5 years ago now, and then your current memoir that just came out? What's the differences between them?
Well, The Cave was that at the beginning, I didn't want to be filmed. I didn't want to book the cinematographers to film in the hospital. I thought it's dangerous for the hospital and for me also. We were in BCS area and we didn't know what would happen then. So yeah, it happens. They filmed since 2016 till 2018 for nearly 2 years. And not everything is, they can't film everything. So I wanted the people to see everything. They filmed a lot. They filmed many victims, many massacres, like many children. And I always like to focus on children to show the world that children are who pay the price of the war. Children are the real victims. So I always talk about the children. So maybe we can share something or stop this war. So yeah, I wanted to show that these children to the world, the children's faces, their injury, their pain, that they were starving, they were suffering, the fear in their eyes. But in the documentary, it wasn't, couldn't show everything because, and they chose this, and then I agreed with them not to show the injured children, for example, that, for example, many children lost their hands or lost their legs by bombing. So they said, the team of the film said, it's hard to see for everyone. People will not see this, will not be able to see this. And also many things happened there. I wanted to tell the whole truth about what's happening there. I wanted to tell how Syria was before the war, before the revolution, to tell the story. Many people watched the game and start to watch the documentary and start to ask questions. They said, so why this revolution started? What happened? What? There's many questions needed an answer. I wanted to answer all these questions to start from the beginning, through telling my story, like one Syrian person's story, one Syrian woman's story, how we were living, the oppressed for women, that we have no democracy, no freedom, no human rights in Syria, why we start this revolution, what we need. And I tell everyone that we just need the basic human rights and how this regime tried to kill everyone, even children, to just stay as a president with his family and the people around him. I wanted to talk about the victims, their suffer. I wanted to think about everyone, and I know many children who suffer. Also, it's not easy to tell everyone's story in the book, but I tried to tell, write their names, tell everyone about them. They are real people, real children. They have names, they have lives, they have dreams. And many of them die without no one knows about them. So that was very important to me. I focused on the book about the period this time, the war time, the siege time, like nearly 6 years. But it was important to tell how we were living and to tell, highlight a little about the women suffering, especially to being in a position like I was the manager of the hospital. Telling about how they force us to leave and how I feel. You can see me in the documentary that we just get on the buses and we leave. They force us to leave to somewhere else. But I wanted to tell how I felt. There's many things to say about this. But just being out of your hometown, I love my family house. I love the place I lived in. I loved the hospital. I worked in the hospital for nearly 6 years. So I love the place, also in addition to the people there. So there's a lot to tell about the feelings. Also, it's hard to talk or to show it in a documentary. I wanted also to highlight on the refugee situation. I was very lucky refugee because I didn't go through the sea, for example. Many Syrians go through the sea trying to arrive to Europe or somewhere else. And they witnessed their children drowning in the water in front of their eyes. They could do nothing. Many people starve in the sea, trying to arrive there. So looking for a better life for themselves and for their families, for their children. So there's a lot to talk about. I wanted to tell this story for the history. I try to get help from the people who read this story because this is still happening in Syria. It's not in. And after 12 years or 13 years now, many people forgot about Syria. So we need, still people in Syria still need help. So I want to remind people of Syria.
This podcast is sponsored by Indeed, the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast, you can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Even my kids used it for their first jobs because it's so easy for all ages to use. But also you have the benefit of they have been around since ye olden days. I mean, I got my career break on Indeed. But since then, they have grown so much, now leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. In the minute that I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WholeView. Just go to Indeed.com/WholeView right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WholeView. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I was so moved by so much of what you're talking about and sharing in your story. I think it is so hard to imagine that these things are still happening. The stories that you're telling feel like I'm reading something from hundreds of years ago. And to think that is still happening today, that's how people are living and the risks that they're willing to take in order to get to safety for themselves, for their family. It was incredibly well written. And I think you did an amazing job of telling the stories of the individuals, not just yourself, but of the individual people that you're helping. It really stuck with me. It was the mom of, I think she had three children, and you were telling the story about a chemical warfare attack and just the absolute loss that she felt of all of her children not making it. And as the mom of four children, like, I just cannot fathom. I literally cannot process what it would be like to be in my home and have to worry about my children's safety. I worry about tweaking their nutrition or focusing on their wellness in different sorts of ways. And we can't think about wellness and health and those kinds of things without thinking about the safety of people is first and foremost before we can think about anything else. And I think you did an amazing job telling their stories. They're not forgotten. They're not lost. And hopefully we can continue to be aware and help people, not just in Syria, but in so many different places that are experiencing war right now. It's such an atrocity in the world. I personally read the book while I was in the hospital with a loved one. We were like in the hospital all day long waiting for help and services. And it was such a striking difference to be having the experience that I was having in our modern hospitals here, and then reading about the cave and your working conditions and how you were treating people with very little resources and all those things. Can you talk a little bit about what is the cave? Why is it called that? And your work that you actually did there?
Well, as I said, the Syrian regime started to target everyone, to kill everyone who participated in the protest against them. So they started to also to target hospitals. That was a scary thing for the wounded people, injured people. They are not unable to go to the hospitals. So the doctors there started to move underground to work just to hide and to help the patients and the injured people. So we start working in a basement. It's underground place. It's unhealthy to be a hospital. The hospital need to be a little sunny, to be a good place for the patients. It's not good to be underground in a dark place. And we started in two rooms in a basement, an old basement. And it was like old and dirty. We cleaned it, started working over there. My colleague, Dr. Salim Namur, who started this place, and I joined him immediately. So we expanded. We make the whole hospital underground, and we make tunnels underground to be able to move because of that heavy bombardment on the ground. So we called it a cave, the cave, because of this. I mean, it was like a cave, just hidden place, underground, dark place. That's why. And we stayed there for nearly 60 years. So sometimes I missed to see the sun. We were in a VCS area. The Syrian regime prevented the food, prevent the medical supplies, the medicine from coming to us. It was a very hard situation, something you can't imagine. I didn't expect that to live in a VCS area. It wasn't normal in Syria to be unable to get bread, to get food, to get baby formula. And many babies died in front of us because there were no baby formula. So it was a very hard situation to be able to work in a hospital without medicine, without medical supplies, without many devices. And we used the medical devices that we had before, but it was hard to get more. So many people were needed something that we don't have. I worked as a pediatrician, as I stayed in the clinic inside the hospital. So many times, many children came to me. They were sick. I know what they are suffering from. I know the medicine they need, but just we don't have it. I just sometimes write it and say, this is the medicine that your child need, but it's unavailable. It's hard to say this. In the midst of the famine, I many times ask the child about their pain, and they said, I'm hungry. Do you have some food to eat? It's very hard to see. The children are suffering from the hunger. And when we hear the sound of the bomb, you can see the children, how they feel. They are just afraid. They understand nothing. Just afraid because they know that this town is scary. It will kill them or kill some people around them. It destroy everything. They have nothing to do with the war. So yeah, it's a very hard situation, in addition to the bombing, to everything, to be diseased and unable to find food for your children. So it was very hard situation.
I actually found myself wondering as I was reading, and you were working nonstop, relentlessly trying to find solutions. How did you take care of yourself? How did you eat? How did you cope in those moments with the trauma that you were experiencing?
It was very hard to think about myself and everyone, I mean, in the medical team and the health workers, to think about themselves, especially because we always see people in very bad situation, and we always feel that we are very lucky because we are healthy now. I'm not injured by this bombing, so I'm very lucky. This is what we feel. We eat the food that, you know, is found that we plant, many people plant some food. So what we found, we eat. Sometimes after, especially after 2015, we were able to smuggle food from the tunnels. And when the Syrian regime found these tunnels, they bombed it, destroy it. And then people make another tunnels and try to smuggle food again. And this is what happened. We just found what we eat this day. We know nothing about tomorrow. So yeah, every day we eat what found. Sometimes many times we slept very hungry and we had nothing to eat. And sometimes we eat this barley bread. It's very bad quality bread, actually. And it was available there because the Syrian regime allowed some of the army leaders to smuggle it with very high prices. So they took a lot of money and give us this barley, and we make it bread to eat. So it was available for like 3 or 4 years from the siege time. So what we found, we eat. And to think about our like mental health, our what we think about this, I really wasn't able to think about that in that time when I was there. But I think a lot about this now, and the time when I left. In 2018, we forced to leave. So since 2018 till now, I couldn't forget anything. I start to remember the details, the people faces, the children faces. it's very hard now. Very hard. It's harder than that time. I was busy there. I was working all the time, day and night. So I couldn't think about this. But now I start to think, when I left, I start to think, how did I do this? How did I do this? Why I didn't help this person? Why I didn't give some time to this person to, you understand what I mean? Start to think about everything, about being a manager of the hospital. Start to think about my mistakes. Of course, everyone has mistakes. I did many mistakes and start to think, I did this wrong. I should do this. And it's very hard to remember everything and blame yourself. I blame myself. Many times we have many people in a big massacre, for example, the chemical attack. And I blame myself because I didn't help everyone. How I was able to choose some people to help and not to choose the others. And the others died because we didn't help them. So it's very hard to feel like this. I really blame myself many times.
It's heartbreaking to hear that because I hope logically that you did so much to help so many people. And the trauma that you experienced, like you have your own pain to process. And it's hard to hear you say that you feel like that PTSD that you're experiencing is more about what you could have and should have done differently or more, instead of, I would think about it from the perspective of what you had to endure to help those people, right? Like, it's two different things, and it breaks my heart to hear that you are thinking about your mistakes or what you could have done differently, because I talk a lot on the show about mental health for those of us who have been through nothing similar to what you've been through. And yet we still talk about the importance of the mindset of like letting go of the shoulds, letting go of like all the stuff, because it doesn't help. It doesn't change anything. And in your case, that's such a big burden to bear, that you've already done so much for so many people. I wish that I could just like take that away from you, right? Like all the stress and all the burden that you're holding, I just want to like physically take it off of you, because not only did you do so much to help so many people, but you endured incredible odds to be able to do it. Just the, as you said, managing this underground hospital, to be respected as a leader, as a woman in the environment you were in, was huge. Can we talk a little bit about what that was like to manage the actual hospital? Because I'd love for listeners to hear what you did do to help people, because you were there, because you were willing to be brave and resilient in all of this. Because that's how I see you, as a very just incredible hero, powerful, brave, resilient person. But I know in those moments, it was a lot for you to overcome.
Thank you so much. I always said I'm just a human being who witnessed and who see everything around us, who see these people who need help. And this is just is a responsibility to help each other. So I just started to help. I was working in the cave since 2012, at the end of the 2012. So I was working with my colleagues, and some of them were managed the hospital before me. And I said, okay, I'm a doctor like them, and I know what this hospital needs. I started working in the hospital since it was only two small rooms, and we expanded. I know the hospital very well. I can do something to improve the hospital. I had a plan to improve it. I thought a lot about things that we can change so it can help us. So I thought I can be a manager of this hospital like them. And they actually believed on me. My colleagues, we were like 12 or 13 doctors, and they elected me to be the manager of the hospital. But my community, and as I said at the beginning, I'm from a conservative community who doesn't like to see a woman in a position, especially where there were men work under her, so they don't like this. They said, you can be a pediatrician in your clinic, it's okay, but you can't manage this hospital because you are a woman. That was their only reason to be could still refuse me. And I remember an educated young man who was working with us in the hospital, and he was a friend of mine. Then he said, "We have no problem with you. You are our friend and we like you, but we don't want a woman to be our manager." So yeah, I feel like it's a new challenge now. I have to do something else besides working as a doctor in very bad circumstances. I wanted to prove that women can do this. Why? Women can lead. Women can do everything like men, or maybe better. So I said, I will do this. I will prove for everyone. I will do my best. And I started to do my best. Many times I have many people came sometimes to me, men come sometimes to me and say that we don't want to talk with a woman. Sometimes they said, if there's a woman in this place, so this place will not be good. I heard a lot of this, but I just continue working. I got angry. I got frustrated many times, but I just continue working. I hired many women also in the hospital because I believed in them, because they deserve to be hired, not because only they are women. And they also did a great job. We improved the hospital in 2 years. It was really a good hospital. We expanded more and more. We make these tunnels. We protected the hospital. It became the central hospital in the area. So I think that I did my best. And after these 2 years, many men came to me and they said, you did a great job. The same people who believed that women can't do it. I mean, that was very happy moment to me, because I believe that we can change the situation. I was able to change these people's minds, what they think. They believe this in like many years ago. It's like traditions and customs against women, and they change their minds. So it's possible. This is very promise that we can change this situation. And I'm very happy now. I always tell everyone that all the bad things, all the customs or traditions can be changed, that just we have to continue working, do our best, and everyone do their parts, and we can change the situation.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Boncharge, maker of science-backed wellness products. Did you see my recent article about safer anti-aging alternatives? I featured their award-winning red light face mask because it had some serious science behind it, and it is a painless alternative to Botox fillers injections that I am currently trying. In my quest to reduce inflammation, decrease rosacea flares, and not look like the mama for teenagers that I am, I did a ton of research on red light masks, and in a systematic review and meta-analysis, so we're talking huge comparative information, red light and near infrared light, like the Boncharge mask, were determined to have cosmetic benefits, including reducing signs of aging, but also reducing scarring, dark spots, and blemishes, while promoting firmer, more even-toned, and youthful skin. Not to mention help with psoriasis, rosacea, melasma, and other inflammatory skin conditions. And studies show that it lasts up to 1 month after stopping use of the mask, which is a sign of lasting cellular structure rejuvenation within the skin itself. I've gotten a couple of questions from y'all about the potential use for it with your teenagers as well for acne, and all of the information that I'm finding in the science supports it as being really positive potential benefits, and there's no downsides or risks associated with it. Absolutely no adverse events in any of the studies, which was incredible. And that's because what's really cool about the mechanism of this is how it's actually reducing inflammation in your body. Red light stimulates a protein that enhances energy production in human cells. And this boosts mitochondrial efficiency, which supports cellular efficiency and facilitates your body's own healing process, even for autoimmune and other inflammatory conditions, which is why you see celebs and everyone online scaring their partners and pets while turning back time. Double bonus. You can start tackling your skincare goals in quick 10 to 20 minute sessions from anywhere in your house. I love the mask's flexible design, which contours to your face perfectly. It's so comfortable. I specifically chose Boncharge because it's award-winning, consistently positive reviews, and is super easy to use. The most important part, I actually use it because it's cordless and effortless. Like, you can walk around with it. You don't have to stand plugged into a wall or something. Order the Boncharge Red Light Face Mask today and start seeing the amazing skincare benefits. Trust me, it is worth it. For a limited time, my listeners get 15% off when you order from boncharge.com and use my exclusive promo code WHOLEVIEW at checkout. That's BONCHARGE.com. You'll also get free shipping and a 12-month warranty. Go now to get this exclusive offer. That's boncharge.com with promo code WHOLEVIEW to get 15% off. You were fighting your own revolution, so to speak, teaching people.
Exactly.
Yes. How did you connect with being able to tell your story via first the documentary and now, like, what motivated you and how did you connect with the team to do all that you've done in sharing your story?
Well, I was just working in the hospital and the three cinematographers came to me. In the area, there were not enough, like, there were no journalists, I think. But when the situation started, many people will carry cameras and started to film and to show the world what happened.
Like the citizens.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So these three cinematographers were just students in the university before the revolution. And they came to me and they said, we want to film you and to make a documentary. And we knew nothing that time. Just they were start filming. We don't know how long. We don't know for what. I mean, they know the director of the film and they just wanted to start filming. I said, no, it's dangerous for the hospital. Maybe the senior regime know about the hospital or know about me. It's unsafe. And they said that it is good to tell the truth. And they tried to convince me. At the beginning, I said no. And they came to me three times. And I said, no, I don't want to do this. But then I said, okay, why? Many massacres happened in this time. So I said, let's show the world what's happening. If we're still alive, people will know about this. And if maybe all the people died in the area and no one knows about us. So I said, let's show the people what's happening. I didn't know that they will film me. I thought they would film in the hospital to show the world of everyone. But then after 2 years, I knew that they will focus on me as a if they want to tell the story through a person, not only film in a hospital, showing the hospital work. So yeah, I didn't want to do this in the beginning, but of course I'm now proud that I was able to tell everyone the stories, especially now the Syrian regime is still there, controlling everything, continue doing crimes, and people are still suffering. So it helps to tell people around the world what's happening. Maybe we can get help, maybe we have to continue peacefully fighting to get our rights.
Absolutely. And I think one of the additional benefits that can come from that is all of the learning that those of us who are now hearing your story, and because you were so brave to let the cameras in, because you're willing to share your personal experience beyond what even the camera captured, I think there's so much of that experience that we're now able to, outside of that lived experience that you've had, fully understand what's happening. And I think try to learn a lesson from it, right? And it's hard for me to say that because clearly lessons have not been learned and change has not happened, because not only is this still happening in Syria, but we're seeing more wars rise after. And I wonder what kind of takeaways or lessons are you hoping that people have as they read your book, watch the documentary, are learning about these things? Like, what can we take away from the experience that you're brave enough to share and have lived through?
Exactly. The main goal of telling the story, writing the book and showing the documentary was to show the people the horrors of the wars. How children are suffering, women, men, who want nothing but some human rights. The children understand nothing. Really, it's heartbreaking to see these children a bit of these circumstances. So I wanted to show this so this never happened again. But it happened. It's happening, as you said, many places in the world. And this is really heartbreaking to see this. But we still have to continue showing this, educate people, make them aware that it's, you know, is something that we can change. We can make pressure on the politicians and everyone so we can stop these wars and take lessons from what happened. War will not solve any problem, not solve any situation. It just make the situation even worse and worse. It just kill innocent people who pay the price of the war. So yeah, I'm sometimes feel frustrated because war still happening. Also, I wanted to tell about the Syrian people, especially who's still alive and still suffering, especially who live in camps now in Syria, inside Syria, and like neighboring territories, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon. They are in very bad circumstances. They're still suffering every day. They live in a tent. Many children live in a tent. They have no even bathroom. I know like 100 families. They have only one bathroom in the camp. They have to wait to go to toilet. It's really, I can't say nothing about living in a tent, especially in summer. It's very hot. In winter, it's just flooded with water or covered with the snow. It sometimes flies with the wind. And that you imagine you find your children just sleeping in a tent and it's raining above them. It's very hard to imagine this. So I just want to say to everyone that you have your children around you. They are safe. They are not hungry. They are warm. So think a little about other people. I believe that everyone can help. And I wanted people after read this book, after know the story, to try to help. You can do a lot as a person. You can do a lot. You can talk about not only about the people in Syria, about the people who are suffering everywhere in the world. There's many people who are suffering, many children. Talk about them, make everyone aware about them, try to make pressure on the politicians, talk to your parliament members, to everyone. You can donate also for these people through many organizations who are trying to help. You can make change.
Usually I ask what is something positive and actionable that people can do. And I feel like you just answered that. But I think even more, I'm thinking of, as you're mentioning, beyond just, you know, the stories that you're telling about Syria, but also of the absolute tragedies happening in Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, Afghanistan, now back under the Taliban, like still happening in Syria. There's so many atrocities that, as I'm listening to this, feel so overwhelming. And for those of us that have tried to learn and talk about it, it almost feels like it's not enough. And so I want to reiterate what you said in terms of following up with your representatives in wherever you live and asking from a political perspective for more to be done, that we can provide humanitarian assistance. And there's all, even though our country might not be in the war, if we truly care about health and wellness, then we care about the health and wellness of everyone. And to know that my children are safe and warm in a bed, but that somebody somewhere is watching their child be, you know, starved or experiencing bad weather or fearing for bombs. Like, all of these things are just heartbreaking and something that everybody deserves safety. Everybody deserves to be treated with respect. And that's not happening in so much of this country. And so I don't know if you have anything else you want to add to that list that you just gave, but I wanted to emphasize that just sharing or resharing stories on social media is not making a difference. Like, we have to be having conversations, and the divisiveness between who's right, who's wrong is not helping the individual people who are suffering from this war. As you said, like, there are actual children who are the ones who are experiencing the fallout of this. And the more that we talk about the divide or whose fault it is or who's the bad or whatever, instead of saying, how do we solve the problem for all the people on all sides that are stuck in the middle? Because nobody deserves to be experiencing and being living through a war.
Yes, Nafi, thank you for saying this. And yeah, really, again, after reading this book or knowing about what's happening, I just recall everyone try to do something, even simple thing, and it can help.
I want to point listeners to your book, The Cave. As a reminder, it is out now and available. If you'd like to read it, you can find it at a local bookstore, or I got mine on Kindle. It's a great story, The Cave, A Secret Underground Hospital, and Wamun's Story of Survival in Syria. And actually, I have not yet watched the documentary, and I'm going to watch it with my kids. I'm going to tell them you were on the podcast and teach them about what is still happening and show your bravery and all that you've endured. And I know that as a parent, that could be a great way to help our children understand beyond like the versions that they're hearing on TikTok about things. Like, it is interesting the information that is out there for teenagers. So to be able to take something like your story in the documentary, in the book, and to share that with the children to say, like, look, nobody is winning in these circumstances. And by making one person a good person or a bad person, all we're doing is fueling that nasty fire that needs to end. And so that is my plan. And I hope, listeners, that you're feeling inspired to want to bring this into your own life in some sort of way, because, like I said, we can't think about health and wellness of ourselves if we're closing our eyes and ears to everyone else in the world and those people around us, because public health is community care. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Amani Ballour. And I will encourage all of you listeners to find her at Instagram, X, Facebook, all the places. You can just search for her name, and we'll put links in the show notes for you for both the documentary and the book. I want to thank you again so much for being here. Is there anything else that you wanted to say before we?
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you'd like to find the show notes and resources at realeverything.com, they'll all be waiting for you, or you can get the show delivered to your inbox ad-free on patreon.com/levelview, which is a great way to support the show. And if you want to, I would so appreciate leaving a review. If you've been motivated by listening to the show, if it touched you in some sort of way, just taking a few seconds to leave a review and say so helps other people be willing to give the show a try and for us to be able to reach more. It doesn't cost you a thing, but maybe like 30 seconds. It makes a huge difference, not just in my life, but imagine if this story could be in the hands and ears of more people. Don't forget to follow and subscribe in whatever podcast app you're listening. And as always, we appreciate your willingness to be open to growth through your own personal change. No one is perfect, but in listening, learning, and unlearning, we can choose to become better versions of ourselves for not just ourselves, but for everyone in community. So thank you again, Dr. Money. It's been wonderful to meet you and listen to your story.
Thank you so much.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.